Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
How are you?
Good.
I am honored to have this opportunity. I really have not done anything in quite some time. My name is James Vaughn. I like to play with that and say I'm Vaughn, James Vaughn, double O brethren. I know you like, what in the world? He called me back and was like, how do you spell your name? But the thing is, I've carried many titles. But to just give you an idea of my history and what I came from, and then just a little idea of possibly understanding this poem, because this is probably one of my heavier pieces that I ever wrote. Like, it literally came to me in dreams. I would wake up and just write another piece to it, I started Incarcerated Flavors when I came home from serving a 10-year sentence. I served 10 years, 10 months in jail from when I was 18 till I was 29. And during the course of that time, I studied public speaking and facilitating groups, and I dedicated my time to educating myself and then using that education to help educate those that were on their way out the doors and returning home. Most of these individuals lacked education. And when I say education, I mean basic education. I mean how to read, write. I read letters for people that had life in prison. They're never getting out. So could you imagine being in a place where you're surrounded by a bunch of people that you're supposed to have this idea, like, we're all tough, but trust me, there's a bunch of babies. I was a baby while I was there, because it literally is. Like, I was taken in by a bunch of guys that came from an era of revolution. They were mostly all Black Panther or Black Liberation Army individuals, guys that will probably never get out. And they said to me if they ever see me again, it wasn't going to be as friendly. So I came home and hit the ground running, started this organization, and was blessed to be embraced by Utica. I've seen you guys everywhere. I know your faces when I see you. I know your car. Look, I know who's who and like who really has our best interest in heart. Not everyone does. Everyone is not as welcoming. Go ahead.
James, did you go through Omar?
Of course. I went through the whole thing.
Mr. Bond, my number in Omar was 68007. It was. It's a fact.
007, 68. Right?
I've been there too.
So 99B2667, that was the number that they gave me. And I must say that prison changed me. I saved a lot of people in the process. I see people today that are like, well, thank you. They thank me. They find me on Facebook when they come home from prison. And I've been home almost 10 years now. And they still coming. So And it hasn't been an easy ride. I started out real right. And then along the line, I went through something that was so tragic. For me, anyway. Everybody gonna handle things the same way. And I really didn't see this coming and never thought it would be me. But when I lost my parents, I lost my dad before I came home. I lost my mom 2 years ago. That took the wind out my sail, honestly. It made me feel like, because I'm not from here, all my family's in other states. So, and these are things that we just got to think about as, you know, service providers. Like, and this is when I started to kind of regroup and recalculate the possibility of relapse. Relapse is, we only use in the term of drugs, but it's a lifestyle. What about the people that don't get high, that's just attracted to, if I get to the point where I say, I don't give a, you know what, right? I could easily turn off, take this little scarf off, go throw my hoodie on, my Tims, my jeans, and be back on the block with it. Like, just like that. And that's a reality for everybody that come home. And I really didn't expect this reality for me. I was like, that'll never, ever happen again. Not going backwards. I lost my mom's. I felt like I should have been helping her. And instead, I was trying to save the world. So I beat myself up for quite some time. And literally, and this is ironic, I just came back from South Carolina over the Thanksgiving few days. I went to see my grandchild. Yeah, I'm a grandfather. I don't probably look like a grandpa. I'm a grandpa. Like, so I stopped down in Virginia. We laid my mom's and pop's headstone down. And then when I got back, literally yesterday, I got a phone call. So it was like, first day back to work, and it was like, it's time to get back to work. So, without further ado, I don't want to keep going because I could tell you all about it, but this piece I wrote is my depiction and my visions of what prison was for me. Let's do it. Six a.m. Dogs start barking, lights start flashing, keys are clashing, chains are clinking, neck hairs raising, hands back and face start sweating. Muslim, Christians, and Jews are praying. This must be how slaves felt. My rights, I would vote. The moment I chose to sell coke. Our criminal justice system is no joke. Certainly when most of them are wolves in sheep clothing. Double lives are lived by many. Excuse me. Double lives are lived by many. For who are we? For nobody really knows. For we were told by somebody. This must be how slaves felt. How, why, what was I thinking? Our black male population is shrinking. And I contributed to our extinction. Does that make me a house Negro without distinction? This must be how slaves felt. Stuffed on a bus, shackled and cuffed, black boxing it up. This must be how slaves felt. Left my home shore, must be a long tour. There's an outhouse in here. This. Destined for a different land. This was not in the plan. And the strange man that governs this land does so unjustly. Is it because my skin a little dusty? I know the smell in the cell is musty. Must be from the millions that have been kidnapped before me. This must be how slaves felt. Mandatory programming daily. 10 cents an hour, stripped of all your power. No longer a name but a number. And if thought to believe otherwise, your space they were sure to plunder. This must be how slaves felt. I've been here for so long, I feel so wrong. I know I'm a black man, I know I'm strong. This must be how slaves felt. I got rabid in my blood. I wish this hole would flood. Knowledge and wisdom and understanding is freeing us away from captivity. Uplift this gravity that has got a hold of me. This must be how slaves felt. My people, my mentals and physical chains have now broken. My captures are now shaken as my people are awakened. This must be how slaves felt. I'm telling them all your kingdom shall fall. And as Maya Angelou said, still I rise. This must be how slaves felt. I pulled up and I dipped down. My ambition is full of extra clips now. From dilapidated schools to high-tech penitentiaries. It's been going on before our eyes, way before President Kennedy. This must be how slaves felt. Hung by a jury of my peers. Humiliation of plant fear in the eyes of those who bear the real tears. Made an example by the subplanter. This must be how slaves felt. I seek my maybe mission papers. I'm done running capers. These walls give me the vapors. This must be how slaves felt. Well, the truth is in the youth. The proof is in the youth, and it takes a village to raise our babies. Well, our babies are going crazy. Oh, hold on. I'm so sorry. It takes a village to raise the babies, and our babies are going crazy. Due to this perpetual cycle, I'm ready. I put my hands on all your Bibles. This must be how slaves felt. I apologize.
Yeah.
And I mean, in closing, that is not my best rendition of that. I literally looked everywhere for this poem today, and I didn't have much time to look. But I was like, I ain't gonna let them hear that. The whole gist of it is, it's like, I never knew what it felt like to not have the ability to get up, go, and do, and I mean the simplest thing. If I gotta use the bathroom, I gotta ask for tissue. So it's like, you are stripped of all of it. Like, there's days when individuals are going on drafts, and I'm so sorry for like just taking too much time, I feel like. But there's days where individuals going on drafts where I can just recall vividly the chains were hitting the floor. And you hear these chains, I'm telling you, through the whole building. Like, you just hear chains and chains and chains. And then I had the opportunity to read Amistad. And during that book, he spoke about how he was like so tired of those chains and the sounds of those chains. And that kind of is what sparked it. But we don't realize how slavery was just changed from previous to this modern day system that we have in place. And people are still capitalizing off it, unfortunately. So if I can assist in any way, I really appreciate being able to come and share my experience and information. But I would like to somehow get involved in a much more direct, relatable way for individuals coming home. Thank you.
Thank you.
So the United States leads the world in incarceration, with over 2.4 million people behind bars. A 500% increase over the past 30 years. The United States has 5% of the world's population, yet it has a quarter of the world's prisoners. More than 60% of people in the prison are people of color. For black males in their 20s, 1 in every 8 is in prison or jail on any given day. 3/4 of all persons in prison for drug offenses are people of color. And they don't do more drugs and don't sell more drugs than white people do. Very comparable in what people are doing, but very different in how it's being treated. And 95% of those in prison never had a trial. So, is this liberty and justice for all? So, Emily Napier Singletary and her husband Derek formed the group Unchained to address this incredible situation. Emily.
I'm going to try not to lose my voice. I've been having a little trouble with it.
So thank you, Pete, for the introduction. Thank you, Kim and Oren, for this space. Thanks, John, for doing the bulk of the organizing to bring me here, I think, at least being the point of contact for me, which was very helpful. And to John and Pete for taking us for a delicious Indian dinner before this. I also want to thank Chris White, who came with me from Syracuse. He's on our board of Unchained. And also, James did about 10 years in prison and went in right about the time, right about the age you did, and came out right about the age you did. So, you know what? My husband is calling me right now. I'm going to answer it. I think he forgot that I'm here. But we'll tell him. So my husband's number is 11B2347, and he's in Elmira Prison. So I can't call him back. Hi. I was just talking about you because I'm giving this talk in Utica. I'm standing in front of the microphone right now. Do you want to say hi?
We're going to speak at you.
Right. Let me see. Hold on. I'm going to see if it'll pick up if I hold it up to the mic. I don't think it's going
to
be.
You had to put the earpiece close to it. You had to put the mouthpiece close to the microphone.
Huh. I know, I don't think it's going
to
work anyway.
Put the earpiece to the mic.
Hold on.
You could plug it in with the cord too, that would work 100%. Plug it in here.
I can't plug it in there.
She's got the new iPhone.
Yeah. Just say hi, let me see if you can hear me. Just a little bit.
Let him know we praying for you. We all right, we out here, we free. We need you out here, period. That's all we needed, you free in the community.
Yeah, you hear? He said that's a fact, he wishes he was out here with y'all.
Period. Get right, be out here, stay out here.
That's so, I was just about to start this talk. So, yeah. I know. That's okay. Yeah.
Tell him we said that.
He said you're gonna talk for 45 minutes? That's a long time. Yeah. Okay. So can we talk tomorrow? Yeah, yeah. Okay. All right, yeah. Love you more. Okay. Bye. All right. Sorry, thank you for interrupting that. The phone schedule in prison can be very sporadic. So usually he calls in the afternoons, but he couldn't call this afternoon and he forgot I was doing this tonight. So, but I'll talk to him tomorrow. So yeah, so Derek and I founded this organization Unchained together, and we think it's just really important that when we're doing work around abolishing prisons, which is our, you know, what we envision for the world. We don't think we're going to achieve it in our lifetimes, but that's our aspirational goal. We think if you're doing that kind of work, you have to have people on the inside as part of that fight because they know what it's like. They're experiencing it right now. And so, just to give you sort of a little story to illustrate how important that is. A few months ago, Derek and I were talking to some groups in New York City who had successfully built a campaign to make phone calls from the New York City jails free. So right now, anywhere else other than New York City, and still in New York City because they haven't implemented the new law yet, to receive a phone call from somebody in jail or prison costs money for the person on the outside. You have to set up an account through these corrections technology providers. There's a whole industry built now. And the cost of those phone calls range depending on where the person is. For folks in New York State prisons now, a 30-minute phone call for me with Derek costs me $1.43 for 30 minutes, which is not terrible considering what it used to be. I don't know, James or Chris could probably, I don't remember what it used to be, but way more than that.
$5-6 for that little half
hour. For a half hour, for one click, yeah. So you can imagine the burden on families if they were trying to keep in touch with their loved ones. In our local jails in Syracuse, that same 30-minute phone call costs $4.25. The same 30-minute phone call you would get, that I would get from Derek, that costs $1.43. So there's a wide range for the cost of these phone calls. But these groups in New York City all got together, formed a coalition, and got a bill successfully passed through the New York City Council to make phone calls free from the jails in New York City. And so I was all excited and was telling Derek about this, and we decided, you know, we wanted to do something to build on that campaign and try and take on, you know, something related to that in our local jails in Syracuse and Onondaga County. But when I told Derek, you know, about the victory, to me it was a big victory, I was all excited, and the first thing he said was, but babe, if phone calls were free, everyone's going to be lined up to get on the phone, and how are we going to be able to talk? Because everybody's going to be trying to get on the phone now that they're free. And, you know, he didn't mean this isn't a great thing that they're free. Of course he thinks that they should be free. But the thing that this coalition in New York City didn't take into account was the unintended consequence of making the phone calls free, which is that now there's not enough phones to go around. There's already not enough phones to go around, and time is very limited on the phone. Like this phone call that I just got from him, we would have only been able to talk for 15 minutes, and then the police would have told him hang up the phone, and that would be it. So I say that to say that only somebody who's on the inside and living through that right at this moment would think of something like that as something that needed to be taken into consideration in a campaign like that, right? And I was actually telling Chris this story on the drive here, you know, and he was saying, oh, I don't know, I don't think it would be that bad. People could still get on the phone, you know, and then he realized he was talking about his most recent experience was in a medium security prison. And, you know, it had been many years since he had been in a maximum security prison, which is where Derek is. And the access to phones is totally different. In a medium security prison, you have a lot more access to the phones at all times during the day. Whereas in a maximum security prison, you're literally locked in your cell all day until they let you out to go to the mess hall and to go do whatever program you do. And then once a day to go to rec, which is when you can use the phone. So even for someone like Chris, you know, who had been in prison, he's a little bit removed from that experience of being in a maximum security prison, and even having the perspective of someone formerly incarcerated didn't quite get us close enough to how we really needed to attend to that issue of making phone calls in the jails free. So I say that just to illustrate how important it is to have those people involved in a movement like this. There's really, it's a great thing. There's a lot of attention now being paid to having formerly incarcerated people in the movement and in leadership roles. And you see a lot of prominent formerly incarcerated people in positions of power these days relative to, you know, what we used to see. But what is still missing from a lot of the work is the perspective of people who are still on the inside, like Derek. So Derek's serving a 20-year sentence. He's about halfway through it right now. And it's for a manslaughter, and we're always very upfront about that. We don't try to sugarcoat what he's there for. And he did do it, so we don't, you know, we try not to gloss over any of that stuff and be upfront about it. And it's a big part of the work that we do is to push people to think about not just addressing the low-hanging fruit of the drug offenses, the nonviolent offenses, but that we also really need to significantly rethink how we deal with people who commit violent crimes as well. And, you know, we don't have any magic solutions to that. There's no magic number, I don't think, for how much time somebody needs to serve. But, you know, what I do know from knowing many people who have been through the system and obviously knowing my husband is that, you know, 20 years is too long. We're the only country in the world that sentences people to times of that length. That would be unheard of in another country. So it's important to keep, you know, our U.S. system in context with the rest of the world. So I'd like to do just a little exercise, if you'll indulge me for a minute. And if you're comfortable, just close your eyes and picture the place where you feel safest. Picture a safe place for you. And just think about that for a second and sit with, you know, that feeling of safety for a few seconds. Would anyone be willing to share the place that they thought of? Yes, sir.
The bathroom in my home.
The bathroom in your home.
In my home, but then I began to wander.
Wander where?
Actually, for that street.
Fill me in.
It's an area that it used to be, and it kind of still is a commercial area, but, you know, to changes in demands, the area has changed to not be safe. I don't know how I got there. You know, I mean, I thought about my most recent visit there, and I just remember, you know, a lot of stuff going on, but I still felt safe.
Right.
You know, so I got from home, sit down home, and then I'm thinking, like, really, okay, I'm like, safe. Yeah, and I began to.
Thanks. Anyone else?
Actually, when I started to think about where I would be safe, I was just going all these thoughts about what's not safe. Listen to the news, I think, just going to my local cafes, somebody might be talking something, have a bad day. And do something. So then I got to a seaside.
Seaside.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Anybody else want to share what they were thinking of? So I haven't heard anybody say a place with a lot of police yet. No. Was anybody picturing a place with a lot of police?
No.
Anybody picturing a place where people are kept in cages? No. So, you know, I do this because I think that we all intrinsically know that police are not what makes us safe and keeps us safe, but we sometimes lose sight of that when talking about the issue of crime. And I think what we all know, you know, based on what you all have shared, what other people have shared with me doing this exercise, is that, you know, people feel safe where they have peace, right? Where, like in your home or on the seaside, right? People feel safe. A lot of times I hear people say, they name places where they feel safe, but also who else is there with them, right? So they feel safe when they have certain loved ones around them. They feel safe when they have a certain type of support, right? And so I think what we all know really deep down is that the safest communities and the safest places in our communities are not the ones with the most police, but they're the ones with the most resources and support and
love for people. And that's the world that Derek and I envision, is a world where we don't need police, we don't need prisons, because people have the resources and the love and the support and the peace that they need in their lives. When people's basic needs are met, and when we are not fraught with all of the consequences that come with capitalism and white supremacy and these really big picture systemic problems in our society, then we can imagine a world where we don't need police and prisons anymore. And so that's the world that we're trying to build. And like I said, neither of us thinks that we're going to get there in our lifetime, but it informs all of the work that we do. So we, you know, we're always asking ourselves in any project that we're conceiving or thinking about taking on, you know, does this get us closer to abolition? Does this get us closer to a world without police and prisons? And I thank James, and I love that he made a lot of the connections for me that that I usually make about this abolition movement and the abolition movement that many of us think of, you know, which was the movement to abolish slavery. And, you know, we take this abolitionist approach because we do see those two things as intricately connected. And similarly, you know, just as ending slavery was once considered, you know, a bold and unattainable goal, and it was, right? There were not a lot of abolitionists during the time of slavery. We like to all think that we would have been them during that time, but there weren't that many. And, you know, it was a very bold minority of people who took that position, and a lot of the abolitionist movement was built by people who were themselves slaves. They were organizing rebellions, they were organizing escapes, they were taking their own freedom into their own hands and liberating themselves and liberating each other. And in this abolitionist movement, where our goal is to abolish police and prisons, we think the same thing is going to be true, that people will look back on this point in time in our country and think, how could that ever have been the way that things were, right? And we also think that the path out of this crisis of mass incarceration and mass criminalization that we're in will be charted by people who have been most harmed by this system. So it'll be, you know, this path will be charted by the people who have been to prison, by the people who are in prison right now, by their family members and loved ones who are on the outside, by people who maybe have never gone to jail or prison, but they've been arrested and they were sentenced to probation, right? That's a part of this whole apparatus of control that we're talking about. People are familiar with the terminology of the new Jim Crow now, right? That's made it into the public consciousness. And, you know, just as James alluded to, there was this evolution, you know, from slavery to the prison system. And in between there, we had Jim Crow, right? Moved from slavery into Jim Crow, and then we had the prison system. And the new Jim Crow is talking about the consequences of getting caught up in that system, and that it's so disproportionately black and brown folks who get caught up in that system that they're then relegated to a life of fighting barriers every day that follow them around because of their justice system involvement. So I'll set the context for this a little bit in terms of, you know, how we got here. And Pete, you know, mentioned some of these figures as well. So it was really sort of a 4-decade period where we had this unprecedented expansion of our prison system. So by 2012, we had 2.2 million people in jails and prisons across the country, and that was seven times more people than we had in 1972, prior 40 years prior to that. So this all happened within a four-decade span. And people, so I'm 37, people, you know, my age, people younger than me, don't remember a time that our country wasn't like this, right? For us, we always were locking up this many people. But it was not that long ago that this is not how we were dealing with problems in our society. And that increase in the number of people incarcerated was paralleled by similar growth in the population under, you know, what some people call correctional control, community supervision, parole and probation, essentially, right? So there's more than 7 million people on some kind of parole or probation in our country. That amounts to one out of every 33 adults in our country is under some kind of control in the community of our criminal justice system. So, did we have a crime wave? Like, why did this happen? what happened? Why did the system expand like this? Rockefeller, yes.
Bill Clinton.
Rockefeller drug laws, Bill Clinton, and the
super predators.
Yeah, super predators. Yeah, Bill Clinton and the Crime Act in the 90s.
Privatization of the prison system.
Privatization of the prison system itself and of so many components of the system. So like in New York State, we don't have private prisons, but like I just said about the phone calls, we have private vendors that keep our prisons running, right? Even though the prisons themselves are not private. So there is a whole industry there and there is a whole profit issue there. Yeah. So during this period that the incarceration population and the number of people under supervision in the community was exploding, there was no uptick in crime. Like, crime was actually decreasing during that period, and it wasn't because we were locking more people up. Like, there's study after study that will show those two things were completely unrelated. Instead, you know, this really was a result of the, you know, the get tough rhetoric that started in the 60s, really started manifesting itself in the 70s and 80s and continued into the 90s with Bill Clinton and others. And so our, you know, the net of our criminal justice system was stretched to include a whole bunch of social problems that were never defined as criminal in the past. So all kinds of things related to, you know, behavior of people with mental illnesses, right, criminalized. Drug abuse, criminalized. Acting out in school, criminalized, right? All of these things that used to be dealt with in different ways, we now are funneling through the criminal justice system. And so millions of people whose behavior wouldn't have been considered criminal 30 or 40 years ago are now getting caught up in that system. So let me just give you one example that I always find pretty astonishing. So the American Bar Association found that 40% of federal crimes enacted since the Civil War were passed into law between 1970 and 1998. New laws on the books, right? 40% of federal crimes enacted since the Civil War were passed into law between 1970 and 1998. Less than 30-year period of time. So, obviously, this expansion of the system didn't impact all of our communities evenly. Nationally, the incarceration rate for African Americans is 4.6 times higher than for whites. And while 1 in 106 white men is locked up on any given day, that number jumps to 1 in 36 for Latino men, and a staggering 1 in 15 for black men on any given day are locked up in our country. So we've seen a little bit of a reverse course on this in the past 8 or 9 years, I would say. Our New York State prison population has started declining a little bit. 13 prisons have been closed across the state. So things are going, you know, starting to go in the right direction in some states. There's a lot of different explanations for that, but the common factor behind all of them is grassroots people mobilizing and putting pressure on our public officials and our elected officials to do these things, right? So one thing we know, especially when we're talking about black and brown folks, is nothing is conceded without a demand, right? You have to fight for everything. Nobody is doing things just out of the goodness of their heart. They are pushed to do these things. And so just to give you like one really well-known example of how grassroots organizing and directly impacted people have really shaped a lot of these reforms, and this is for people coming home from prison, not necessarily people in prison right now. But so how many people have heard of Ban the Box?
Black boxing it up.
Ban the Box. No, not that many people. Okay. So Ban the Box is the movement to remove the criminal history question from job applications. You know what I'm talking about? How on a job application it asks you, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Ban the Box is the sort of, you know, catchy term for the movement to take that question off the applications so that people can have a fair shot at employment. So that movement, that policy of banning the box wasn't thought up by, you know, a lawyer or a social worker or some kind of community advocate. It came from a man named Dorsey Nunn, who is himself formerly incarcerated. He lives in California. He founded an organization in the 90s. I can't remember what year exactly, but called All of Us or None. And they are the ones who really developed this idea of banning the box and popularized that movement. And it has spread across the country now. Dozens of cities and counties have banned the box. Entire states have banned the box. And you know, it all came from this man who was formerly incarcerated himself and knew the struggle of trying to get a job with a criminal record and was mobilizing other people who were having the same experience, you know, and it's now this very popularized movement that has support from really all sides of the political spectrum now. Nebraska banned the box statewide.
Wow.
Like that's how that's how mainstream it has become, right? Red states are banning the box. I'm gonna try and hold on to my voice here. So another example of this is a few years ago when I was working for a different organization, somebody who we were working with, a person who had been formerly incarcerated, came to a few of us at that organization and showed us that he was trying to apply for college, and he was actually applying to Herkimer Community College, close to here, but he was from Syracuse, And he saw on the application that they had a little statement that said, if you live out of county and you have a felony conviction, you will not be admitted to Herkimer Community College. A community college, right? A college for the community that essentially has an open admissions policy, right? You don't have to have certain test scores or a certain GPA or anything. It's open admission. So we were, you know, flabbergasted that this was a thing, that schools were doing this, and started looking into, you know, how widespread was this practice? Were other schools doing this? And ended up putting out a couple research reports about it and became part of a statewide coalition working on these issues. And really ended up having a lot of victories related to that over just the course of a year or a year and a half. So let me, just to set the stage for that and why this was such an important issue, we know that across the country, 43% of prison or of people will return to prison within 3 years of their release. So almost half of people released from prison will go back within 3 years of getting out. But if you earn a bachelor's degree while you're in prison, that number drops to just 5%. So from 43% to 5% if you can get a bachelor's degree while you're in prison. If you get a master's degree, it's less than 1% go back to prison. So investing in higher education in prison is one of the best ways to keep people from going back to prison, which of course in the grand scheme of things decreases our prison population and allows us to shut prisons down, right? Getting us closer to our goal of abolition. So, of course, because this is the US, for more than two decades, college and prison has been essentially non-existent, except for a handful of privately funded programs. It was Bill Clinton's 1994 crime bill that put an end to that because they that put an end to access to college and prison because they made people in prison ineligible for Pell Grants. So you couldn't get Pell Grants for financial aid anymore, and that's how colleges and universities were paying to run their programs in there. They were getting financial aid from incarcerated students just like students on the outside, right? And that's how they were funding their programs. In 1995, Governor Pataki here in New York did the same thing with TAP grants. So you couldn't get any federal financial aid anymore, and you couldn't get any New York State financial aid anymore. And so overnight, the college programs pulled out of prisons. There are a few programs operating now across the state that are privately funded. So there's foundations funding some programs in a few of our New York State prisons. Cornell University runs one of those programs, and they're in Auburn, Five Points, Cayuga, and they just started up in Elmira, which is where Derek is. So he had been in a college program in Auburn a few years ago, but then when he got moved to a different prison, they didn't have that college program anymore, so he was on hold. Now that he's in Elmira, they got that program up and running, so now he's back in the college program. But, you know, that's how arbitrary it is. You know, if you get moved to another facility, you don't have access anymore to the college programs. So you had, you know, these college programs disappear in the 90s, and then a decade later, in response to campus crime that really had nothing to do with people with criminal history records, just we were seeing, you know, it's when we first started seeing mass shootings on college campuses and things like that, and people got freaked out and started putting this question on the college admissions application about, have you ever been convicted of a crime before? Even though none of these campus crimes had been committed by anyone with a record. But that was the response to this fear about safety on campus, was to exclude people with criminal history records. So I have like a 2-minute recording from Derek that he recorded a couple weeks ago for an event that we were having, but he talks for a couple minutes about how important the college program has been to him, and I just like for you to, you know, hear his voice a little bit and hear things in his words. So hopefully you can get the audio on that, and you'll be able to hear it this time because it'll come through the speakers.
This is Derek Singletary, co-founder and co-executive director of Unchained. I'm here in Elmira Prison, and I can honestly stand here on the phone right now and promise you that there will not be one piece of reform that will have a greater effect on law and recidivism than the expansion of college programs in prison statewide. Not one. For me personally, college has allowed me to see and understand the error of my thinking through the lens of institutional racism and how I was actually working for it instead of working against it. However, I think for us as a prison population, the biggest thing college does is remove that feeling of resignation, of having to still do some things illegally that I think we all pretty much feel when we step out of these doors. It is, in fact, another door, another option, and another path that we wouldn't even consider to peek down without it. Nationwide, 43% of people come back to jail within their first 3 years of getting out alone. Yet less than 6% of people who graduate with some degree in prison ever come back to jail at all. So why is it that less than 5% of the total prison population nationwide has access to higher education? I think that's the biggest question these lawmakers need to consider if we're being for real about prison reform, because it's the easiest solution to a question that's not nearly as complicated as it's been made. True knowledge enlightens, and enlightenment is the only way to change mentality.
Derek really, you know, he really credits his ability to take part in these college programs with his transformation that he's undergone in prison. When he went in for the manslaughter, he was 25 years old, and he's 33 now, and he's not that 25-year-old who committed that manslaughter anymore. And even though it's a very heinous crime and people are still hurting from that, it doesn't mean that people who commit crimes like that are not capable of transformation and capable of redemption. And that's one of the messages that we always try to send, is that we, like I said before, we have to start grappling with the issue of violent crime as well, and how to deal with that. Even if we emptied out our jails and prisons of the people with drug offenses and people with nonviolent offenses, we'd only empty out about half of them. So we really, if we're serious about shrinking our jail and prison population in a really significant way, we have to start thinking about how we're handling people convicted of violent crimes as well. So with respect to the higher education work, you know, we were able to help build a coalition of directly impacted people and won some victories at the federal level and at the state level. So in the last year of the Obama administration, he launched a pilot program to move toward restoring Pell Grants to incarcerated students. And that so far is still moving forward. It hasn't been dismantled yet. So fingers crossed on that. And then something that we're very proud of at the state level is that we were able to successfully put pressure on SUNY as a whole to ban the box on their admissions application. And of course, Herkimer Community College is part of SUNY, and that one person who had been formerly incarcerated and showed us the application is what sparked all of this. And we worked on that for 10 years and finally got SUNY to to ban the box, and that just went into effect in 2017. So that's brand new. So thanks. That was a big victory that we could work long and hard on. So I'll give you a couple examples of campaigns that we're working on currently, just quickly. So they're sort of at two ends of the spectrum, right? So we're talking about creating a world where we don't need jails and prisons. We're talking about emptying out our jails and prisons and shutting them down. We have to do that by stopping the flow of people who are going into them in the first place, and we have to stop the flow of people who are going back once they get out, right? We have to attack it from both sides. And so that's what we're doing. One of the major campaigns that we're working on right now is a statewide campaign to overhaul our bail system in New York State. Bail reform, ending cash bail, has been, you know, a big topic of conversation over the past year or two, really made it into the national mainstream consciousness. And so here in New York State, on any given day, we have 25,000 people across the state in our local jails, not in the state prisons, but in our local jails. 25,000 people, and 70% of those people have not been convicted of anything yet. They're just being held there pre-trial because they cannot afford to buy their freedom and pay their bail and get out while their case is still pending. They're legally presumed innocent under our Constitution. They have that right to have their presumption of innocence protected. So the thing about New York State is that we actually have one of the most progressive bail statutes in the country already. It's just been terribly implemented for several decades. So the purpose of bail is to make sure you show up for your court dates, right? It's not meant to be a punishment. It's not tied to the severity of the crime. It's just tied to your risk of flight, risk of failing to show up to court, right? That's what it's supposed to be based on. It usually surprises people to know that in New York State, under our existing statute, judges have access to 9 different forms of bail right now. When you hear that bail gets set on somebody, what do you usually hear? What types of bail is usually set?
Cash or bond.
Cash or bond, right? I heard both of those, right? That's what we hear, right? Something like $5,000 cash, $10,000 bond, right? The bond is an insurance company bond, which is a private business, right? A bail bondsman is a private business. They are profiting off of people having to buy their way out of jail. So when a cash amount is set, that means you have to pay the court that amount of cash in order to get out. But you get that cash returned to you at the end of your case. So as long as you show up and handle your case, you get that money back. Even if you're found guilty. If you're found guilty, they deduct a 3% administrative fee from it, but otherwise you get the rest of it back. If, for example, your cash bail amount is $5,000 and you can't afford to come up with that amount of money, which most people caught up in our system cannot, then you might go to a bail bondsman to get out instead. And if your bond, the insurance company bond is $5,000, you have to pay that bail bondsman usually 10% of that to get out. If it's a very high bail, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, you might have to like put up your house as collateral or your car as collateral or something like that. You pay the bail bondsman that 10%, and they go and bail out your loved one. They put up the rest of the money to the court for you. When you finish, you know, going to court, your case is all resolved, you never see that $500 again. That's the fee that the bail bondsman charges you. That's how they make their money. So, you know, they're profiting off of people in very vulnerable situations. A judge has to set two forms of bail, but she has seven other forms available to her other than cash and insurance company bond. And a couple of them don't require you to put up any cash up front. So we have a system where people, where under our existing statute, judges have the ability to set these forms of bail tomorrow. Those options are available to them tomorrow, but they don't set them. And most people don't even know they exist. A lot of judges don't even know that they exist. So one of the things that we're working on at the local level is a court watching project where we have trained over 50 community volunteers since September to go in and observe arraignments and document how bail is being set, what forms of bail are being requested, you know, what are the amounts of bail being set, and what are the reasons for that. We're doing that so that we can, you know, have statistics and have data to show that Onondaga County is not implementing that bail statute with integrity, right? We can show that they have never, you know, in the more than 300 cases we've observed so far, they've never set one of the other seven forms of bail, right? They've only used cash and insurance company bond. So that's something we can do at the local level right now to try and get judges and prosecutors, you know, on board with overhauling, not even overhauling our bail system, just implementing the statute as it was intended to be implemented. But then there's also a statewide campaign to rework the statute a little bit. And instead of leaving it up to judges to make those decisions, just creating a presumption of release for people charged with misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies. It says people don't need to be held in jail. They don't need to have bail set for this level of crimes. They should be released on their own recognizance so that they can handle their case in their community. Our jails would practically empty out tomorrow if that happened, upstate at least. In New York City, most of the people held in local jails are there on felonies, but upstate, most of the people held in our local jails are there on misdemeanors, which is just really absurd if you think about it, that we're holding people in jail for months at a time on misdemeanors that they have not even yet been convicted of. People lose everything. They lose apartments, they lose jobs, you know, their life is completely disrupted. So that's one campaign that we're working on, and then another brand new one that we're going to be launching in December is a campaign to overhaul the way that parole functions. And this is the piece about stopping people from going back into prison, right? So, like I mentioned, you know, our prison population has been declining for the past decade or so, actually by 31%. But the number of people who are going back on parole violations has increased 21%. So we have a problem where, you know, we're sort of stopping the flow on the incoming side, but now we're increasing it on the people who are returning. So in 2012, New York State released about 9,300 people from prison. Half of them went back within 3 years. And of those, 84% went back on what are called technical parole violations, meaning they did not commit a new crime. They simply violated one of the rules of their parole, like missing a curfew, for example, could send you back to jail. So half went back, and 84% of those were for technical violations. So we're in the process of drafting a bill that will be introduced in the 2019 legislative session that would, for most technical violations, make it impossible for a parole officer to send you back for that. That, based on the idea that we should not be sending people to jail for not committing crimes. That doesn't make sense, to be sending people to jail for not committing crimes. And it also would give people an incentive to do well on parole by giving them credit for time that they successfully complete. So for every 30 days that they successfully complete on parole, they would get a 30-day credit off of their total parole time. So rather than punishing people with a stick, we would be incentivizing people with a carrot, which we think is a much better approach. We shouldn't be holding jail time over people's heads for things like violating curfews. So I'll try to wrap up. I think if we're really, you know, if we're really serious about being successful in transforming the way that we think about criminalization and incarceration, we have to do a few key things. So one of those is we have to really double down on progressive local and state level reforms. Almost all of our criminal justice policy is set at the local and state level, not at the federal level. There are relatively few people in federal prison compared to our state prison systems and local jails. So while many people, you know, are dismayed with our current administration, myself included, at the federal level, the good news is there's a lot we can do at the local and state level to counter what's happening at the federal level and to minimize the impact of what's happening at the federal level. Because what really impacts people's day-to-day lives in terms of the criminal justice system is state and local policies. So we have to really double down on those. Secondly, I think we have to be really bold in naming the root causes of the crisis that we're in. And that's white supremacy and capitalism, for the most part. That is what's driving this crisis of incarceration and criminalization, and we have to get real about that. And with any type of reform that we're looking at, we have to ask ourselves, you know, is this tackling issues of white supremacy and capitalism, and is this getting us closer to abolition? Is this about shutting down our jails and prisons? So being an abolitionist doesn't mean that you can't support specific reforms. You certainly can. It just means that you do it through a lens of, is this getting us closer to abolition? And then finally, and you know, for me probably most importantly, I think we really have to, like I've said, invest in and center the experiences of people who have been through this system and the loved ones who have supported them through that. We're not going to get this done, and we're certainly not going to get it done right if we don't have those people at the forefront of this movement. And remember that anyone, regardless of the type of crime that they committed, should be a part of this movement, and nobody should be discarded or devalued just because of the nature of the crime that they might have committed. That everybody is capable of transformation and of redemption. And so, you know, I think that if we can come together and do those few things, and I'm not saying they're easy things, they're hard things to do, but I think that if we can do those things, we can really start healing a lot of the damage that has been done to millions of people across our country. And I'll stop there for now. So I think this is a conversation, right? So,
yeah.
A lot of hands. Go ahead, Warren.
I am, just to touch on the last things you said about the lens that you look through and the one that takes on white supremacy and capitalism, and personally I think they're inseparable.
Yeah.
I think capitalism is always dependent, it's been founded on white supremacy.
Right.
from the very beginning. It's what allowed the exploitation of the rest of the planet from Europe, you know, to move into Africa and to South America and here and pretend that these people that existed in these places and had civilizations weren't people. You know, it's been white supremacy that's driven it from the beginning. And I think that fact feeds the big mythologies we live by. One, that our armies are out defending our freedom, and two, that the police are here to protect us.
Right.
Yeah. So those are myths that have to be debunked.
Mm-hmm.
People have to see clearly through those lies to begin to shape something different.
Right.
And it takes, it's a really radical shift for a lot of people because their entire life they believe these things essentially as part of their worldview. Mm-hmm. So that's all.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
No, no, it was a young lady over there. She was on that.
I wonder, and you didn't mention that, what role plays, for example, insurance companies? Well, my experience was that I had a tenant and he came out of jail and I tried to find him a job. And I heard from some institutions here that they say, well, we cannot hire people who come out of jail because we would lose our insurance. So the insurance companies actually, they set the parameters what they possibly can do.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on that, but I have heard similar things from a couple other people. So I think that's an area that's ripe for investigation and action.
Yeah.
The federal government will bond you up to $5 million. You don't even have to worry about that. That's not even a question. If you get a clearance for a security job, the federal government will bond you $5 million. Guaranteed off the top.
There is a federal bonding program for people with criminal histories, but even with that, we've heard some stories from insurance companies. I think they're finding some ways around that, unfortunately.
Did you?
Yeah, I'm just trying to work my way across here.
In anticipation of this, I was thinking about how, at least on TV, documentaries, a really important part of the narrative of violent crime is for the victim or the family, the closure that they get from the violent offender going to jail. And so I guess I'm wondering, it seems like you may have some experience with this, so I don't want this to be too personal, but you know, what types of things do you say about violent offender reform that would be an alternative to prison?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. I weirdly have experience on sort of both sides of this issue because 11 years ago I had a nephew who was murdered and then I married a murderer. So there's there's a lot going on there. I think, you know, I mean, everybody's experience with victimization is different, you know, and what brings closure to people is different. You know, my experience with most of the people who I've talked to about things and most of the people in my family is that that's what you're taught to believe, right? And that is the message that you receive from sort of pop culture stuff, right? Is that's what brings closure. And so a lot of people go through this whole process of, you know, going to the court dates, victims, you know, going to the court dates and, you know, making sure that the person is held accountable and goes to jail and all of that. And then once it's over, they're waiting for that sense of closure and it never comes, right? And so they've been led to believe that they're going to get something out of doing that and then it never quite materializes for them. And that can be re-traumatizing in a lot of ways. So, I mean, I think the question of, you know, what do we do instead of prisons is one that we might not be really ready to answer right now, because, you know, this country's imagination has not been pushed that far yet. But, you know, I mean, what I will say is that there are plenty of other countries to look to as models, which the U.S., you know, does not like to do on anything. But there, you know, there are other countries that still have prisons, but they look nothing like the prisons that we operate in this country, right? There are prisons where people have the keys to their own cells, and they freely move around, you know, within the facility and come and go when they want. There are prisons that don't even have walls and fences around them, but there's a culture of accountability, and people stay there and do what they need to do to work on themselves and go back to society a whole person, you know, whereas our system here beats you down and releases broken people back into our society. So I don't know. I don't have an answer, but that's as close as I can come right now. Yeah.
Thank you. It struck me that you mentioned, and I've forgotten the exact statistic exactly how you parsed it, but 31%
a decrease in the state prison population. It's decreased 31%. Yeah.
How do you account for that? What's the reason for that, you know?
So a big piece of it, I think, is attributable to reforming the Rockefeller drug laws. Mm. You know, which I can't even remember when that happened. About a decade ago, probably.
I remember when
when they finally repealed a lot of that stuff. So, you know, I mean, we did change significantly how we deal with drug offenses. And that emptied out a lot of prisons, I think. Not just here, I mean, Rockefeller drug laws are specific to New York State, but the rest of the country, you know, has been doing stuff around that too. So I think that accounts for a lot of the drop in it. And now we're seeing that our prisons are more filled with people convicted of violent offenses now. So you're not seeing as many going in on the lower level drug stuff and nonviolent stuff. You are seeing them fill up with people on violent offenses.
So by the 21, the other, conversely, you mentioned at the same time a 21% increase
in the people being returned to jail from parole.
Is it just this same stupid garbage you were mentioning, you know?
I don't know. I honestly don't know what to attribute that to. It's behavior of parole officers, you know, so they're sending more people back than they were in the past, but if people have ideas about that.
I just thought of that, you know, years ago my son was on parole, and he's a community activist now.
Yeah.
I remember him telling me and my sister something about an officer trying to get him on something that he didn't even do.
Yeah.
So how rampant is that?
If it's one of those technical violations where they just violate what, you know, where they say you just didn't follow one of the rules of parole, the burden of proof for that is shockingly low. I mean, all the parole officer really has to do is say that you did this. They don't have to prove, you know, they don't have to prove anything.
Yeah.
And that's something that the bill we're drafting would change too. It would put in some due process protections for people. Yeah.
My question to you is, how do you work from the inside? You mentioned like people that are committing crimes going in,
mm-hmm.
and people that have come out that are re-entering, that you try to work from those to positions. But how do you work from the inside, you know, for the problem?
So, I mean, I think part of that is the higher education issue, right? So, like, we know, at least for the foreseeable future, we are going to have people in prison, right? That's the reality. And so we better figure out how to do a better job with that than we're doing now. And I think, you know, one of the big factors in that is what programming is available to people in there. And most of the programs run by the prison system itself are useless. And that's evidenced by the fact that people, half the people who come out go back to prison, right? Obviously, it's not working. So, but we know what the numbers are if people have access to college in prison, right? And that number drops to 5%. So, you know, and like Derek said, you know, our policymakers are making a very complicated issue out of something that's really quite simple and would make a huge difference for people in there. Nancy, did you?
Just a couple things to share. One is my brother works in policy reform in Ohio, and when they're working on the policy changes for prison reform, they front it with safety. So as you were saying, the last few decades, it's always tough on crime, but putting people in cages does not make our communities safer. In fact, it could make it less safe, right? Because families are destabilized and communities are all shaken up. So when we're working on these issues, fronting safety, is these policies will actually make us safer. Mm-hmm. So problem is that politicians get elected on tough on crime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we need to push pressure to be elected on safety, because that's what we want. And a couple of things to your question, Andrew. One is there in Canada, they have this pilot program called Circles of Support, where when someone came out and was all voluntary, the person coming out would have 8 volunteers, and one would be focused on their housing, one would be focused on their physical health, one would be focused on employment, one would be focused on their social life, and one would be focused on spiritual or all the different facets. And the recidivism rate for people in that program is 0.
Sure. Of course.
Okay. There's one thing that's so we know what works. It's not great for capitalism, but also
what works,
there's plenty of money. There's billions for nuclear weapons, so there's plenty of money if the public will is there.
Right.
And second, another example. And you must know Danielle Sarid.
Mm-hmm.
So she had a pilot program in New York City where it was victim-based. So it was focusing on violent offenders, but it was victim-centered. So they bring the victim and the perpetrator of the crime together. There was lots of therapy. And it wasn't just like, okay, let's get together and rip. There was preparation, and it was a very specific process. They asked the victim, what do you want? And the victim would decide on an individual basis what that victim wanted. So an example was a man who was mugged. And what he wanted was for the perpetrator to meet his son so that he would know that he was taking a father away. And he wanted what most victims want is to know why it happened. They want to make sure it's not going to happen again. And they want themselves to feel peace and safety. So this man was having panic attacks. He couldn't walk down the street without feeling panicked that he was going to be mugged again. So what he wanted was for the perpetrator, the actual perpetrator, the person who mugged him, to show him how to get out of the chokehold. So they reenacted the crime. And he put the chokehold on him lightly and showed him how to get out. And they did it again and again until he was fully doing the full chokehold on him and taught him how to get out. And the man stopped having panic attacks. So the victim's life was actually improved. Whereas if the man was simply in a cage, the panic attacks would have continued. So I think that when you say we don't have the imagination, we haven't worked on our imagination, like, there's a little blip right there. Like, we could be, especially if we start with youth who have bigger imaginations than adults.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are so many possibilities if we actually wanted to, they call them correctional facilities, but as making our communities worse off.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And what about you touched this issue in your talk? What about working on the legislation per se to bring it to some comparable international standards? You know, so for example, a friend of mine whose 17-year-old son was put to jail for 1.5 years for spraying graffiti on the wall. And things like that. So this you would not find anywhere in an industrial country that a 17-year-old goes to jail with adult people for 1.5 years just for doing some graffiti, you know?
Yeah.
and they probably are sentenced to some community work and have to remove the graffiti from the walls, you know, or something like this. But to find some kind of a balance, of a measurement, you know, that is not so out of whack, you know. This is, I don't get this. I'm from a different country, I'm really surprised to see this here, you know, how people go to jail for 20, for 30 years and for a crime where that is, for example, in Germany called life sentence is 15 years.
Right.
And this is really, really the case.
American example pie.
Yeah, it's always so interesting to me when I go abroad because, like, even people who have nothing to do with the criminal justice system know what a disaster the U.S. is when it comes to our system. You know, in every other country I've been to, when people ask me what I do and I explain it to them, they know how bad it is, you know, and they really have, you know, nothing to do with the system, but it's an international embarrassment. It is.
Yes, sir.
Roger Moore's, or the Gadfly, Moore that does all the dialogue.
Michael Moore.
Roger Moore. James Bond.
Yeah.
Michael Moore, Roger and me. That's where you're.
Yeah. I think it's Portugal, where they have no. There's no incarceration for drug. There's no criminalization.
It's not right. It's legalized.
They got rehabilitation. None.
Right.
At all.
Right. We might get marijuana legalized next year.
Yeah.
We'll see.
And then you think of all the people that have been in jail for that.
Right.
And
exactly. Exactly.
Isn't it ridiculous?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's much fun for people. Just by way of, I was listening to 95.5 The Heat, and you was on.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason why I came is because I'm interested in who speaks for us.
Mm-hmm.
Us are the incarcerated prison. And through your speaking, I said, I don't have a car, so I walk. But it's important enough for me to say, is this a personal endeavor or is this for the benefit of all? So my conception was that you was ill-prepared to speak on behalf, you understand, of a systemic problem with men that go to jail for over decades. A decade is a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? We're not going to blame the system. We have to get out of blaming the system and take personal responsibility for us. And most people incarcerated, like Derek, he takes personal responsibility for his actions, period. So now, but what I'm going to say is this. I came for a solution. Donald Trump, it took 50 years of white people going and talking about the health bill before they even decided. Could you imagine going to work for 50 years and talking? Okay, let's face the reality now. Okay, 50 years. Now, Donald Trump, he's a New Yorker. I'm a New Yorker. I have no problem with a rich white man from New York. He put his money up and get what he wants. Shut up. Make it happen. Okay? Let's talk about Donald Trump in Jersey when he ran them black people off of that Broadway, Broadwalk. We know all about Donald Trump. He's not going to change. He's over 70 years old. He's over grace. Let's stop pointing the finger at Donald Trump. What are we doing here in Utica? Now, we talk about the herb over there. They're going to legalize it. But the woman that got the Marijuana Institute in Massachusetts, she had to leave Utica and go to Massachusetts. And she's got one of the two licenses. Now they got a problem in Massachusetts because they're making too much money. They done made $2 million and they got all kind of police and everything. Y'all done messed up our nice community because all of this here traffic. People is coming from everywhere. They gonna do it here in New York, okay? We're not talking about that. We're talking about what's gonna happen when these men return back to our community. You done did 20 years. You don't have a solution. Everything that you said, I can say contrary. Because I'm Leroy James, I'm minister and artist. I came to Utica, New York in 2001. Utica, New York. Mm-hmm. Today, my son is an entrepreneur. We own 5 homes here and he's in Long Island with 3 down there. Because I decided, mm-hmm. I'm a great grandfather. I didn't want my children to be listening to people like you. I want y'all as white people to tell white people what the problem is and you can't speak for me. No, but I'm saying you're speaking for Derek and you're saying this and that and you don't have a program. You're saying I don't know what the solution is. Bro. Utopia. It's Wait. Not about utopia. It's about working right here. Can we legislate some legislation so I can support you?
Right.
And so Donald Trump just got a criminal justice bill. He's going to put it before the Senate right now. Mm-hmm. He's waiting. How many of us is going to Washington, D.C. to support it? I'm going to New York City and I'm going to support Mario Cuomo for the next president of the United States. I just got off of the stage with whatever his name is. Not Claudia Tenney. I went and talked to her too because I got 500 plus acres in Bainbridge, Georgia for my great grandfather. My family's in charge of the farm. Is concerned about the farm subsidy bill. I went to talk to her when Donald Trump came in here. I ain't giving him $1,000 to sit down and eat with him. But I was right there, okay? I get in. I was there with him. So you know what? I go where God tells me to go and I do what I'm supposed to do. But you know what? I'm concerned about James right there. Because he met me 5 years ago when my grandson shot somebody, left a month-old baby. He saw me at the jail and picked me up. Picked me up. But my grandson just got home and less than 2 months ago, he in New York City selling them cars. He's doing great. Okay, so that's what we're looking for, a solution. Yeah, we ain't looking for a bunch of people talking. That's why I came. I came to support the brother. A couple of days ago, I wrote him on Facebook and asked him what was happening. And now he's telling me he was close to relapse. Who knew that but him? Nobody knows how they're going to deal with mama gone. That's what we're going to have to deal with.
So you're leaving? Are you leaving on
them
note?
I'm going to listen.
Oh, okay.
But I ain't got
I want to say directly to you. First of all, I heard you do 2 things, and I'm just going to say it. I'm not going to pinpoint it to you. You can kind of figure that out. That were disrespectful. Okay?
Maybe you...
Okay. I understand that one might feel that nobody else can speak for you. Because truly, only you can speak for yourself. I heard you say you came here, and your son got, and you got, and he went out, and y'all did that. How many people did you personally take to get that, to get this, what you're talking about? Listen, let me finish. My son went through the New York State prison system he did 7 years, and I'm not saying he didn't do what he did, okay? When he came out of prison, I don't know his struggle, I don't know what he had to go through. In prison or even outside of prison because he was in Syria. I would be saying, my son, the cop killer, if the cop didn't kill my son. Part of that was because he said, Mom, I'm not going back to jail. Trying to get a job, trying to maintain his family, trying to live out the integrity that was born in him, that was built in him, was a struggle for him. Okay? I don't know who reached out to him, but it's easier for me to live with my son was killed by a police officer than my son killed a police officer. Okay? So whatever somebody try to come and do, whatever race, creed, or color.
You gotta respect it.
Okay? That's all I'm saying.
Oh, we respect that.
That's all I'm saying.
When we publicly speak, he said, us,
I heard the
that language.
I heard the statement that you heard, and I thought she was fantastic.
Thank you.
Can I just add on something?
Sir, I just want to say thank you for coming, and I appreciate what you said, and I agree with most of what you said, which is that I cannot speak for people who look like you and have had your experiences. I can speak with you in support of you, but I can't speak for you. You're absolutely right. And, you know, when I was on the radio program that you mentioned with Cassandra, you know, right before this, I actually said specifically, you know, she was asking me about, you know, what do black folks need to do, basically, about this. And I said, I can't sit here and tell you what black folks need to do. As a white woman, I can't tell you that. You could have that conversation with Derek, but unfortunately, we can't have that conversation with Derek due to the circumstances that he's in. So, you know, we do the best that we can with it. And, you know, in terms of solutions, I don't have all of the solutions, but just to clarify, what Unchained does is we don't run programs. That's just not what we do. And that's no shade to anybody who does. Programs are necessary because our government fails at what it is supposed to do. But what we do, like you heard me mention, is different campaigns to change policies, like you were talking about. We write bills, we build campaigns, and go to Albany, where people like Chris, people like James, people like yourself, go and tell their own stories and tell their legislators why these policies need to change. And that's a big part of what we do, is to put people at the forefront of the movement. And I think people who have been there themselves personally need to be at the forefront of that movement, and those of us who are loved ones who have been through that alongside people need to be there in that movement as well. So I think there's a place for all of us in that movement.
And the only thing I would like to add is this. I appreciate you guys for what you're doing. When I came home and seen that people were advocating for me that didn't know me and they didn't look like me, they didn't sound like me, I was blown away because I expected, and I always said this, I expected the help to come from people that look like me. I expected it to come from the churches. I expected it to come from the black church or this place that I thought was gonna look like me. And that's not always the case. If you want help, and sometimes you can't expect it to come in a shape, form, color, creed, age that you want it to come in. It may come in a sense of a white lady that came from suburbs that know absolutely nothing about what we live in, but she's here to strive and help cause a spark. And tonight, when I was telling my lady, she was like, where you going? I was like, oh, I'm going over here. I don't really have much like information, but I'm going. She was like, well, doesn't sound like you have anything particularly looking for, but I said, just a spark. Because sometimes for us, all it takes is a sparking. You'll set me off on a mission that I had no idea that I was engaging on. And in the mission you guys are embarking on right now, I commend you. Because, I mean, I was just helping people, and I'm not going to say just helping people, but I was helping people coming home from prison, get jobs, get in school, find housing, food, clothing. I mean, literally all of the basic necessities. But then I started out wanting to publish art and poetry and magazines and stuff. So it went from just trying to help promote their talents and skills and potential to now it's like, I can't even imagine what it's like having that talent, skill, and potential, but don't have nowhere to lay my head at night. So how can I really relax and draw a picture when I'm hungry? Like, I can't draw hungry. So this thing here that we're up against, it's gonna take everybody. Because in the end, we tell ourselves we see green. But in all reality, you can walk in any facility and look and say, that's the Spanish dudes, that's your Aryan dudes, there go your black dudes, you got your blood ones, you got your crip ones, you got your... We got so many different dynamics, but only time, like, we won't congeal. We won't stand together because of these different Jim Crow laws and all this dynamics that have been, you know, the indoctrination periods that we had to go through to basically make us into the people we are. So we can come here for a good cause, but leave here mad at each other because I don't like the way I was sitting here like, in prisons? In my head, though, I had to remain open because I'm like, that's not possible. You know how hard, and in a part of me, this is probably conditioning too.
Yeah.
A part of me says, we need prisons.
That's conditioning.
We gotta have these here because if not, some people deserve to go to prison. And this is somebody that did time. I was out here like, you should be in jail. Like, how am I battling you because I kind of figured something out that you just haven't yet? And then, here it is, they always tell you, be careful to how you treat people on your way up.
Because you got to see them same people.
You may come down again. You don't know. You don't know how this thing in life is going to play out. So I treat people as people, regardless of where I go and where I've been. I don't care if you're Muslim, Jew, Christian. I'll talk to anybody, any church, anywhere. But I just want to say, you guys are embarked on a battle that you have to have your boots strapped up. Parents tell me, listen, you laughing, I'm telling you. Like, this thing, it can get to the point where even local police can start looking at you like you're the enemy. So you don't realize that I'm just trying to help people. But guess what? You're the enemy. You're trying to put me out of a job. So now you become the enemy to people that we're taught supposed to be helping us. So it's so many different variations. And I just want to say, again, I commend you guys, like, wholeheartedly.
Yes, you know, I want to just say what you said was important. I have worked in the prison system for 30 years. I'll tell you two little things. One is that I used to teach under the Palgrave for the SUNY school system.
Yeah.
I was also an adjunct professor at Utica College. Just to make the point that the best students were from the prison system, and they distinguished themselves much better than the Utica College.
Anyone who has ever taught in a prison will tell you the exact same thing.
So if there's a Utica College professor, man, I'm sorry, but the guys at SUNY and Pell Grants did well. The second piece of what I want to say, and I'm thinking that it might be part of the solution of what could happen, and I'll tell you where I work, which is at Central New York Psychiatric Center. And we worked with migrants, crimes or criminals with violent crimes.
Right.
And there was a lot of very intensive treatment offered inside the prison. I was one of the people who, you know, coordinated all of that and fought in all of that. And the first question I think that we need to answer is like, who are we really dealing with? There are many, excuse me, sir. You need to know who you are working with. Many of the people have little or no education. Single parent families, that's where they come from. Poverty issues. So, and of course, a lack of education. So these people that are in there, what do you do for them? So I think if you know who you're dealing with, you can then plan and target your goals in terms of what you want to achieve. When they have treatment on that side of the fence, we also need to provide a transition form of treatment on this side of the fence. And I think that I'm involved with some of the guys who continue to be out in the streets, and many of them are doing well. But I just want to underscore the fact that we need to provide resources for these folks who come out, and not just expect them, you let them out of prison and let them just go and, you know, like wild horses. We need to be able to continue providing treatment to reinforce their success. Mm-hmm. So the question that the gentleman asked in terms of what is a model that could work, that is what I'm offering.
Thank you for that. And I think, you know, you remind me of something, which is that most of the people who are in our jails and prisons, you know, we think of them as offenders, people who have committed a crime, right? But almost all of them are also victims in one way or another. They have been the victim of a crime at some point in their lives as well. And no one has tended to that experience of theirs and addressed that trauma that they're carrying around that often is underlying whatever behavior landed them in prison in the first place. So thank you for the work that you've done.
Have a good night.
Good night, James.
Thank you. I'm sleeping on the couch because
we're wrapping this up right now anyhow. We've already gone past, we usually cut off at 9 o'clock, and you've worked hard. We really can't. I think, one more question, or take one more comment?
Please don't leave without, I trust you have a card with you.
Yes.
I think you. But I just wonder, it's a little bit off the subject you've been talking about, How much of a threat do you think private prisons are to us right now? Is that a near and present danger? Is it?
Do you mean for the country as a whole, or are we in danger in New York State of having our prisons privatized?
Nationwide, I was thinking, but I mean, however you can address it, is that something that's actually likely to happen?
So,
and how much worse would that be for the problem that we're looking at?
Yeah, in a lot of places, prisons have already been privatized. I don't think we'll end up going that direction in New York State, but especially at the federal level, and a lot of our immigration detention facilities are privatized. And I think that's a huge threat to the movement to decarcerate and to, you know, get people out of our jails and prisons, because when there's a financial motive have someone in there, it makes it that much harder to get them out of there. So I do think it's a threat, but I also, like I said earlier, I think of privatization when it comes to prisons as much more broad than just the prisons themselves, and also think about all of the vendors that keep the prisons running, and the phone companies and all of that. So, privatization is always a threat.